Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Big Bend Sentinel for Thursday, September 15th, 2022. Presidio County approves Operation Lone Star application for County Attorney's Office by Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Presidio County. At Monday's meeting of the Presidio County Commissioner's Court, County Attorney Rod Ponton's request to apply for Operation Lone Star funds was approved unanimously. Ponton is seeking $140,000 to $150,000 to support two new positions in his office, a legal assistant and a paralegal who will carry out investigative tasks. The grant Ponton applied for does not involve matching funds from the county. Operation Lone Star is an initiative launched by Governor Greg Abbott in the spring of 2021 to help fund law enforcement operations in border counties. Texas supports legal immigration but will not be an accomplice to the open border policies that cause, rather than prevent, a humanitarian crisis in our state and endanger the lives of Texans, his office wrote in a press release. We will surge the resources and law enforcement personnel needed to confront this crisis. Presidio County has been awarded around $1.5 million from the state through Operation Lone Star for fiscal years 2022 and 2023. Ponton clarified that he was applying for the money on his own and wouldn't be taking away from the pot of money already awarded to the county. It's just from that statewide pool, he explained. I want some of that money awarded to Presidio County. To support the need for additional funding, Ponton told commissioners that District Attorney Ori White currently has 179 pending immigration cases in Presidio and Brewster counties alone. White deals with felony immigration cases, and Ponton handles misdemeanors. Remember that some felony cases can be reduced to misdemeanors, Ponton said. Smaller amounts of drugs, like marijuana and meth, can be handled as misdemeanor cases. Other types of smuggling, like the recently publicized seizures of Mexican bologna at the border, can also be prosecuted as such. Misdemeanor charges can impact a person's immigration status. U.S. Customs has established a system with a baseline of crimes involving moral turpitude to determine if a person ought to belong in the United States. The moral turpitude standard dates back to 19th century immigration law and generally encapsulates instances of fraud and crimes causing bodily harm. Convictions involving moral turpitude, especially if an individual has committed multiple, can result in deportation from the United States. At Monday's meeting, County Clerk Florcita Subia, who handles jury calls and records records involving crimes handled within the county, questioned the need for additional funding for Presidio County's legal system. This grant is also for clerks to be able to apply for more help, but I don't feel like there's enough of these crimes coming in for me to be able to apply, she explained. Precinct 2 Commissioner Brenda Bentley was also concerned about the practicality of adding two more employees to the county attorney's staff. I know that your spaces, especially the one in Presidio, are not adequate for two more people, she said. Ponton explained that the dollar amount he was requesting was specifically for salaries and not for overhead costs like supplies and office space. Let's get the grant first and then worry about practicalities, he said. Ponton explained that despite the relatively low number of cases being prosecuted by the county now, that he was expecting more as local law enforcement efforts ramped up as a result of Operation Lone Star funding. There'll be more prosecutions in Presidio County, he said. The purpose of doing this is to make it clear to the smugglers that there's no free ride, and so they start avoiding Presidio County. Photo courtesy of Matthew Walter. A Rufus hummingbird perches on a branch in the Tri-County area. Rufus hummingbirds breed farther north than any other hummingbird species and travel long distances, nearly 4,000 miles, from breeding grounds in Alaska and Canada into Mexico during fall migration. City of Marfa hosts budget workshops, grapples with budget deficit. By Mary Cantrell, MKCANTRELL at BigBenSentinel.com. Marfa. It's budget season for the city of Marfa, and council members gathered this past week for a series of workshops to comb through Mayor Manny Baez's 2022-23 proposed budget by department, hear from city staff, and talk over the town's critical needs. As council members left it Monday evening after hosting their third budget meeting, the city was significantly over budget by around $200,000 and needed to make cuts. But with inflation, a desire to give city employees raises, and mounting infrastructure projects, there was no clear answer as to where to make up the budget shortfall. City department heads, including the gas department, EMS, library, nutrition center, and police department, were in attendance to walk through their operating costs and request raises for their staff. Baez said he anticipated the budget would be tough this fiscal year, just based on the state of the economy, and while giving city employees a 3% cost of living raise would be great, the city needed to increase their revenue to be able to afford it. I know we all have a wish list. We all want to give raises, possibly donate more to organizations, whatever it may be, but we have to cover our costs as well, said Baez. The city is anticipating receiving their 2022 tax note, which they voted to approve in June, in the next couple of months. $2.95 million the city will spend over the next 3 years and pay off within the next 7 years. The funds will be added onto existing tax note money the city already has to total around $3.1 million. But for the most part, those funds have already been earmarked for street, water, and sewer infrastructure improvements. We can use it for street improvements, water and sewer system improvements, a new water well, acquisition of vehicles, equipment, explained Baez. So we cannot use those monies to offset our budget. Before council members were ultimately faced with an unbalanced budget, they worked through the proposed budget in the days prior to make sure it reflected current activities, projects, and improvements. On the city administration level, professional services were a source of strife. With City Attorney Teresa Todd's suspension as a result of her arrest last month, the city was spending more than usual on contracted lawyers at $250 an hour, so opted to increase the professional services budget by $25,000 to cover the cost. We are going to have to be using outside legal representation for random things, so it's going to hurt us significantly, said Baez. Council also opted to budget for a part-timer at City Hall who would help answer phones for administration staff, who City Manager Mandy Rohn said were struggling to keep up with the call volume of the city's municipal court customers and others. In discussing Marfa Police Department's budget, Baeza explained the $155,000 of federal and state money budgeted was made up of grant funds from Operations Lone Star and Stone Garden, but additional grant funds could funnel in throughout the year. Brown said the city will be notified as to whether the Community-Oriented Policing Services, COPS, grant it applied for to help Marfa ISD hire a school resource officer was awarded on October 1st. Last year, the city allocated $211,000 of Operation Lone Star grant monies toward funding five new police vehicles and $30,000 of city funds. The city will have to pay off $81,000 toward the leasing of the vehicles over the next 2 years, but recently applied for additional Operation Lone Star funding to do so. This year, the police department will also utilize around $30,000 worth of old Operation Border Star funds to revamp their office space to make it more private and suitable for handling juvenile cases, as well as citizens giving statements and being interviewed. The Marfa Volunteer Fire Department and how to fund its long-awaited expansion project was a popular point of discussion at city budget talks. Presidio County recently announced that they would dedicate $224,000 of America Rescue Plan Act, ARPA, funds toward the fire station expansion project, but those funds will need to be spent by the city, then reimbursed by the county. The city has carried over a budgeted amount of $147,500 for the project from previous years. Fire Chief Gary Mitschke told council members the original construction bid they received for the project earlier this year had since gone up by $20,000, and he was concerned if they didn't start soon, the contractor would back out. And even with the boost of county ARPA funds, the project was still coming up $87,000 short. Councilmember Jason Baumann pushed for the city, who owns the fire department building, to include the full fire station expansion project in their budget in order to see the project come to fruition. "That sounds like we need to increase the budget to the full amount of the project still, if we're going to be waiting on the county to reimburse us, and we need to get this done. It's a primary critical service. It's fire, which is operating at a third of the budget of the police," said Baumann. The option to use money from the 2022 tax note was brought up, but Baeza warned of prematurely allocating the funds when council still wasn't sure how much priority areas like streets were going to cost them. "That $3 million will disappear in a hurry, but I am in favor of completing this project for the fire department," said Baeza, who noted in a later meeting that the fact that two homes in Marfa proper have burned down over the past year was significant. Council agreed to come back to the item at a later date. "Bottom line is, I appreciate anything y'all can do. We really do need it very badly," said Mitschke. The way the Volunteer Fire Department, a 501c3 and not a city-run entity, is funded was talked through at length. City of Marfa utility customers can opt into a bill surcharge, which helps fund the fire department, but Mitschke said those contributions have been on a decline for years. "The city takes money out of those contributions to pay for building utilities and fuel for vehicles and gives the fire department the remainder of the funds at the end of the year. Not too many years ago, that $17,000 was about $35,000. I just want you to know those have really gone down, and it seems like it's doing that steadily," said Mitschke. Hotel occupancy tax, HOT, Historic Preservation Dollars, could be distributed to the fire department for a $40,000 roof repair to the historic section of the building, while the Marfa and Presidio County Museum and USO building are also likely to see hot funds. Director of Tourism Abby Boyd brought forth to the council a laundry list of upgrades needed at the USO, including painting, repairing original floors, getting rid of an unwanted beehive, and replacing ceiling tiles. A preliminary estimate for the work was coming in at $30,000 for labor alone, but the city will seek a turnkey estimate, which includes labor and materials moving forward, for the community facility. There's more that will need to happen as time progresses, but I'm just trying to take care of the major stuff. This is a space that so many locals use regularly. It's very important to the community, so it being a nice place where people can have weddings and parties and things is important, said Boyd. Street repairs were highlighted as a priority this budget cycle by the mayor, and council voted to approve raising the budget from $1.5 to $2 million, which will come out of the tax note funds, for a complete rehab of a handful of city streets. The city already outlined Russell and Mesa streets as in critical need of repair, but will make recommendations on other far-gone streets to be fixed, which Baez said might attract a favorable bid due to the fact it would be a bigger undertaking. The city is awaiting final numbers and data on a water and wastewater study they are having performed, which will help them reassess utilities rates, which haven't been raised since 2015. Rates are likely to go up for both residential and commercial establishments, city officials acknowledged, but are likely to affect commercial entities more. Raising rates is meant to help pay for long-term infrastructure updates, said Roan, like the failing Chinati Foundation sewer pipes and expansion of services into Antelope Hills and East Heights. We have the capital improvement plan, and it's looking at how we're going to pay for several multi-million dollar projects, and that's going to be a factor in the rates, not just how much people are using, but what they're going to be covering, said Roan. Similarly, natural gas prices are projected to increase for city customers, primarily due to the high price of the resource nationally. The city has yet to enter into a new contract with provider West Texas Gas, WTG, and was waiting for rates to become more favorable. Also still in question is a $114,000 bill from WTG the council received in December, dating back to the February 2021 winter storm, which, regardless of how ongoing negotiations with the company shake out, will also need to be budgeted for. The city will hold both a public hearing on the proposed new tax rate and an additional budget workshop next week, September 20th at 6 p.m. at City Hall. Tidewater and Big Bend Foundation announces interest in acquiring Shafter Silver Mine by Sam Karras. Sam at BigBendSentinel.com. Shafter. Last Thursday, the Tidewater and Big Bend Foundation announced that the organization is seeking to acquire Aurukana Silver's holdings in Shafter. The foundation, funded by Cibolo Creek Ranch owner John Poindexter, stressed that it hopes to cease mining operations permanently and instead open the site up for historical preservation and tourism. The foundation wishes to protect this important historical site from further development, including potential open-pit mining, the organization wrote in a press release. The announcement added some intrigue to the ongoing saga of Shafter's water system. Residents have received water services free of charge through the owners of the mine since 1997. Over the past few decades, locals have learned that there's no such thing as a free ride. Most recently, a fire at the pump house shut down water to the town for several days, and financial problems plaguing Arcana Silver, the current owners of the mine, left locals concerned that their water supply might again be in jeopardy. At a public meeting held on August 25th, County Judge Cinderella Guevara and several savvy Shafter locals were under the impression that the mine was being purchased by Presidio Silver, LLC, managed by Mark Isaacs. In response, Isaacs stressed that his company's acquisition of the mine was far from a done deal and would be finalized toward the end of the year when Arcana, a publicly traded company, held its annual shareholder meeting. A representative for Presidio Silver, LLC, declined to comment for this story. A representative for Arcana Silver did not return a request for comment by press time. Henry Thompson, Secretary and Treasurer of the Tidewater and Big Bend Foundation, explained that his organization stood out from the pack because they want to cease mining operations permanently. Instead, they hope to restore some parts of the mine, a blacksmithing shop, the original mill, and some residences in Shafter as kind of living history attraction. An easy way to understand it is sort of a West Texas version of Colonial Williamsburg, Thompson explained. It'd be a good opportunity to get people to stop and tell the story of Shafter. Because Poindexter, who owns nearby Cibolo Creek Ranch, has long-term commitments and interests in the area, the organization could also promise longevity. This mine has been kind of looming over our little part of West Texas for decades. It's changed hands a whole lot of times, Thompson said. Every time it changes hands, there's anxiety. How are they going to operate? Are they environmentally sensitive? Are they going to drain the aquifer? We'd be able to put all that to bed permanently. Shafter resident and former Presidio County Judge Monroe Elms said that one of his concerns, no matter who ended up owning the mine, was the large amount of environmental mitigation the site would need. During his tenure as judge, he worked with the Railroad Commission and other state agencies to clean up cadmium, lead, and arsenic contamination in some of the sites the Tidewater Foundation hopes to open up for tourism. Thompson said that his organization shared those concerns. We're not working off of a lot of information right now, unfortunately, but we have searched the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, and TCEQ, Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, databases, and haven't found anything of concern, he said. But that's going to be a major part of our acquisition efforts. Everything's very uncertain right now, but that's assuming we make it forward to that process. Elms also expressed concern regarding the communication between the potential buyers, local authorities, and Shafter residents. We're all still concerned that the county judge told us that she would reach out to us in an email, and she hasn't reached out as of yet, he said. We've heard nothing from her about the emergency declaration that she was going to make. At Monday's meeting of the Presidio County Commissioner's Court, Judge Guevara informed local officials that she had been in communication with the TCEQ and that there was no state of emergency in Shafter. Water operations would carry on as normal as the potential sale of the mine was negotiated. Guevara also reported that she was still attempting to arrange a meeting with Isaacs, but had not been able to contact him. The delay in the email chain, according to Guevara, was the fact that she had been waiting to get in touch with a state representative from the Texas Department of Emergency Management, but that she was planning to make another visit to Shafter to update everyone as early as next week. They're on the radar, and they're going to be taken care of one way or another, she said. City of Marfa, here's Water and Wastewater Rights Study Considers New Right Plan by Allegra Hobbs, Allegra at BigBenSentinel.com. Marfa. At Tuesday evening's regular city council meeting, council members heard the results of a commissioned water and wastewater rights study, which presented three potential options for the city's rate structure, two of which suggest rate increase, and a third which suggests a new rate structure altogether. Jason Gray of Wildan Financial Services, after presenting the options, was ultimately asked to return with more concrete numbers so that council can vote on a plan in time to finalize the city's budget for fiscal year 2022-23. The city's water and wastewater utility rates have not increased since 2015, according to City Manager Mandy Roan. Rate increases are being suggested now in order to cover cost of service and capital improvement projects over the next 5 years, which could include a new water storage tank and extending city services to the East Heights neighborhood. The first option presented would entail a $7.5 million debt issuance for 2023 and would raise rates by 5% to 6% annually in order to cover operational cost increases. If capital improvement projects or operations change, rates may be adjusted accordingly. The city would be presented with a 5-year rate plan, but would have the option of adjusting annually. The second option would raise rates 8% for the first 5 years, but would then gradually decrease to a 3% increase and would also include $100,000 annually for a vehicle and equipment replacement fund. That fund could be any amount, but Wildan anticipates $100,000 will be the necessary amount. The third option, a meter equivalency rate plan, suggests a model for determining rates based on meter size. Under the city's current rate structure, said Gray, meter size is not taken into account, but larger meters have a great impact on the water or wastewater system and require more storage. All of your base charges for your meter charges are the same, and what that doesn't do is it doesn't recognize the differential impact of a 5/8 inch meter, which is your common residential meter, versus a 2-inch meter or a 3-inch meter. And the reality is those larger meters have a much larger impact on your system as a total, said Gray. Council expressed interest in a plan that would restructure the base rates for larger meters, but also include a vehicle and equipment replacement fund. Gray said he would return with specific rate numbers for that plan within a few days, in time for the finalizing of the city budget. No decision was made, but there is interest in seeing all available options going forward, said Mayor Manny Baeza afterward, noting that council members Mark Cash and Eddie Payares were absent on Tuesday and so unable to hear the plans. After high water brings increase in drowning deaths, body of migrant found in Big Bend National Park. By Sam Karras, Sam at BigBenSentinel.com. Brewster County. On September 7th, National Park Service rangers retrieved a body from the extremely remote Mariscal Canyon area of the park. The night before, the Brewster County Sheriff's Office alerted the park of a sighting of the body in Lajitas around 8 p.m. It passed us right quick and ended up in the park, said Sheriff Ronnie Dodson. Dodson has had plenty of experience with bodies recovered from the river. It's happened at numerous times in his career, especially as water levels rise. The river hit a crest, or high water mark, on September 3rd and dropped to lower levels for the next few days until rising again to flood stage on the day the body was spotted in Lajitas. Migrant deaths due to drowning at high water have made national headlines in the past few weeks. As a collision between a tropical storm and a cold front brought weeks of heavy rainfall to the region. On September 1st, the bodies of 8 migrants were recovered from the river near Del Rio in Eagle Pass. Earlier this year, a National Guardsman was killed attempting to rescue migrants from drowning in the same area. Stephen Crump, a spokesperson for the Big Bend Sector Border Patrol, said that these types of drowning deaths are not that common in the region because the river tends to be lower. This is not something that's typical for the Big Bend area, he said. The Del Rio area is seeing rescues daily. They have a rescue boat out there, as well as swift water rescue training for the agents. Crump said that Border Patrol was notified of the body recovery, but that the Park Service and the Brewster County Sheriff's Office were the only agencies involved in the investigation. The recovered individual was an adult male with no obvious form of identification on his person, said Tom Vandenberg, Chief of Interpretation and Visitor Services at Big Bend National Park. Vandenberg said that the body had been sent to the coroner, and the coroner's office had subsequently notified the Park Service that the body was a 19-year-old Venezuelan male. Brewster County, where Big Bend National Park is located, does not have a coroner's office. The Brewster County Sheriff's Office indicated that the body had been sent to the South Plains Forensic Pathology, a private lab in Lubbock. The lab declined to comment on the matter. Precinct 2 Justice of the Peace Jim Burr is currently awaiting autopsy results. "There's a whole lot of parts to this," he explained. He thought authorities may have found relatives of the person found in the river, but couldn't say for sure. Identified remains of migrants are typically returned to their home country, but diplomatic relations between the United States and Venezuela are complicating this particular case. Typically, the local consulate will handle communication between the family of the deceased and American authorities. In 2019, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, whose legitimacy as a leader is the subject of ongoing dispute, cut off all diplomatic ties with the U.S. The process has been frustrating and time-consuming for Burr. When a foreign national dies, we are mandated by law to contact the consulate of whatever their citizenship is, he said. That's not possible in Venezuela. We're dealing a little bit with the Mexican consulate, but there's no real contact between Venezuela and Mexico either. Burr still considers the case a blank slate. I have no idea who they are or where they're from until I've seen something different.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, September 15th, 2022. Prison Overpopulation Leads to Contingency Fund Use, by Nathan Hewer. Pecos County's Contingency Fund has been a lifeline for Pecos County Memorial Hospital this year and will continue to be through the end of 2023 at a minimum. The county's fund balance is now adding another burden due to prison overpopulation at the county jail, the related rising costs of operation, and the supply chain shortage of vehicles. The Pecos County Commissioner's Court approved the request for funds as needed by the Sheriff's Office and the county jail on September 12th. Pecos County Sheriff T.J. Perkins said Monday's meeting that 14 inmates arrested in Pecos County were being housed elsewhere due to the county jail being full. On average, the county has 20 inmates per week. We have about 38 inmates here, and it's a 48-bed facility. We can't max it out because I have to have room for inmates that get arrested here. We were hoping last year that things would get better, but it didn't. It's put a strain on our budget. Housing inmates at other facilities ranges from $60 to $75 per inmate per day. With 257 days passed this year, the sheriff's office has spent approximately $300,000 on inmates being housed elsewhere. Schuster expanded on why the sheriff's office and county jail has run out of budgeted funds with 3.5 months left in the year. It's a combination of a lot of things. High prices for fuel. We're getting about half the fuel we would be getting based on the price. The other is there is a backlog in the legal system because of COVID. It's now opening up for jury trials. That put extra inmates in our jail for the last 2 years. Another issue is the border situation with the illegals and smugglers. We don't house illegals, but we do house smugglers. The supply chain crisis in the vehicle sector has had its negative impact on the sheriff's office. The sheriff's office is short 2 vehicles as they await for the arrival of 8 new vehicles. It puts a strain on the vehicles, so they're running constantly. Extra maintenance and related costs. We ordered 3 new trucks 2 years ago, and they're barely being made now. We got 5 Tahoes from the Lone Star Grant. They're here, but we can't get the equipment for them. We have vehicles in Midland ready to get lights, cages, and camera systems on them. They're close, but we're in a bind. Health care to include marriage and family therapy by Nathan Heuer. Employees of Pecos County will now have marriage and family therapy coverage as a part of their health care benefit plan through Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Texas. The county was presented with 2 standards that Blue Cross and Blue Shield made on their 22-23 health and pharmacy benefit coverage for their fully insured groups. The Pecos County Commissioners, upon the recommendation of Judge Joe Schuster, unanimously agreed to add the marriage and family therapy to the county's health care coverage. The county decided to reject the coverage for services related to gender reassignment under the pharmacy plan. One of these items is not a very favorable item to me to be able to discuss. My recommendation is to accept the marriage therapy and deny the gender reassignment, Schuster said. The county's base pay and employees' base pay for health insurance coverage will not increase due to the addition of the marriage and family therapy coverage. Pecos County Attorney Frank Lacey said that, as with any medical circumstance, it would only increase if used. It's an additional covering surface, so as it's utilized, the county portion of that will be paid by the county and the rest will be paid by the employee, just like any other medical circumstance. Starting on September 12th, in order to receive COVID leave pay, county pay, employees must provide documentation of a positive test result from a professional health care facility, which includes a doctor's office, clinic, or hospital. Previously, at-home tests were valid to receive COVID pay. To be eligible to use county COVID leave to care for family residing in the same household, employees must provide proof of their positive result from a health care provider and the duration of the assistance required. For COVID leave quarantine eligibility, the same applies and also includes a close contact with an individual who has tested positive. The number of days leave may not exceed the number of days of quarantine exceeded if recommended by the CDC. Get ready to vote in the midterm election. With Election Day 2 months away, the following are steps to ensure that your vote will count during the midterm election that will feature numerous local races, the Fort Stockton ISD bond election, and the Charter Commission election for the City of Fort Stockton. In September, confirm you're registered. Check to make sure you're registered at your current address at registertexas.com before October 1st. If you're not at your current address, follow the prompts to update your address online or get registered. Before October 1st, check your calendar and request a mail ballot. Are you going to be in the county where you're registered to vote between October 24th and November 8th? If yes, great. If you're able to vote in person, you're good to go. But if you're 65 or older or have a disability, you can request a mail ballot. If no, no problem, request a mail ballot. Go to the txdem.com/vbmap, fill it out by October 1st, and an application will be mailed to you. Fill that paper application out and mail it into your election office. Be sure to include your Texas driver's license or state ID number, or the last four digits of your Social Security number, preferably both. Once the elections office gets the application from you by October 28th, they will mail you your ballot. October 24th to November 4th, vote early. Go vote during early voting. Bring your ID and a paper list of the candidates you're planning to vote for. Acceptable IDs are a Texas driver's license, Texas DPS issued card, U.S. passport, U.S. military ID with photo, or a U.S. citizenship certificate with photo. But if you don't have one of these, you can still vote. Call 844-TX-VOTES for more info. If you're voting by mail, make sure you get your ballot in the mail by November 1st. Your ballot must be postmarked by November 8th and arrive by November 9th in order to be counted. Then, track your mail ballot using textdem.com/VBMstatus. On November 8th, Election Day Backup Plan. If you weren't able to vote during the early voting, polls are open from 7 to 7 on Tuesday, November 8th. That's your last chance to vote. Find your location at mytexasvotes.com. If you have any questions, call 844-TX-VOTES. Two Spanish-language films and bilingual play coming up. Fort Stockton Community Theater and the Fort Stockton Film Society will present two Spanish-language films and bilingual play by a theater group from San Antonio during the fest, Thursday through Saturday, September 15 to 18. On Thursday at 7 p.m., the beloved Mexican actor Cantinflas appears in Por Mis Pistolas, with doors opening at 6:30. Por Mis Pistolas is sponsored by Designer Carpets and Interiors. On Friday, the award-winning documentary, The Lost Reels of Pancho Villa, sponsored by Eternity Funeral Home, will screen at 8 p.m., with doors opening at 7:30. Both films are in Spanish, and classic cartoons will be shown before each screening. Admission is free, but there will also be opportunities for donations. On Saturday at 7 p.m., The Panza Monologues, a live bilingual play, will be presented by Teatro Audaz of San Antonio. Doors will open at 6:30 for the free performance. The play is made possible by a Humanities Texas grant and features four women discussing their battle with being overweight and other women's issues. A panel discussion will follow the play so that the audience, the actresses, and medical and dietary professionals can discuss the problems and possible solutions that women face in their daily lives. Burial Fest is a celebration of the Hispanic culture in Fort Stockton, and we feel it's important to present these performances in Spanish, said Alice Dirksen. It also is important that people know that the theater is available for all of our citizens, so we're trying to bring programs that appeal to a broad audience. Everyone is urged to take advantage of these free movies and live theater performances. For more information, call Alice Dirksen at 336-3180.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, September 8th. 80th anniversary celebrated at Rattlesnake Bomber Base Monday. Rattlesnake Bomber Base at Piote was honored with an 80th anniversary event on Monday held at the Million Barrel Museum Complex. Local Boy Scout Troop 675 and Midland Boy Scout Girl Scout Troop 719 made up the color guard, who performed the posting of the colors for the opening ceremony. Ellen Fryer welcomed guests and gave a brief history of the Rattlesnake Bomber Base before guests toured the museum. The bomber base was built in 1942 as a United States Army Air Forces training air base. The base was nicknamed Rattlesnake Bomber Base because of the numerous rattlesnake dens that were uncovered during the construction. At the height of its use in 1944, the base was the largest bomber training base in the United States. The base had over 6,000 officers and enlisted men, either permanently assigned or temporarily attached. It also had hundreds of civilians working there, some locals, as well as civilians from all over the United States. After the war ended, thousands of reserve aircraft were stored there, including the B-29 Enola Gay. The Enola Gay was the B-29 that dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. She made a layover stop on her way to the Smithsonian. Many of the other planes stored there met a more dire fate, the on-base smelter, where they were melted down to aluminum sludge patties. The base was closed the first time in 1954. In April of 1958, the base was reopened as Pyote Air Force Station. The base was a radar installation, acting as one link in a chain of installations that were part of an early warning network in case of Soviet air attack during the Cold War. The station functioned as a ground control intercept, GCI, and warning station. In March of 1963, the Air Force ordered the site to close. Operations at Pyote ceased on August 1, 1963. Visitors were able to view the array of vintage and periodic displays, such as a telephone switchboard, the post office windows and postal boxes, a Browning M2 50 caliber machine gun, and a cutout replica of a bomber, as well as handwritten letters, newspapers, uniforms of the time, and many other interesting artifacts. The Boy Scout troops staged reenactments of first aid procedures performed for the military during the war. The scouts supported civilian organizations such as fire and ambulance services. Scouts worked in very dangerous conditions as fire watchers, stretcher bearers, carrying messages, supporting evacuation of hospitals during air raids, and carrying out first aid. These were all tasks which scout training supported. The Million Barrel Museum Complex, located at 1500 East Seeley, hours are Tuesday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., closed on Sunday and Monday. For Dogi, life paths can change in a heartbeat. The story was written by Jan Cranfill. Hometown girl Kelsey Dogi is one of the new physical therapists at Ward Memorial Hospital. Dogi graduated from Monahans High School in 2015 and entered college in Abilene's Hardin-Simmons University as an English major. Quote, "I had planned to become an English professor or writer," Dogi said, "until I shadowed some friends who were pre-physical therapy students," end quote. Dogi said she was drawn to the hands-on, one-on-one interaction with the patients, and she changed her education direction, graduating with a Bachelor's of Science in Biology with a minor in English. After graduating from Hardin-Simmons University in 2019, she was accepted into Texas Tech University's physical therapy program, where she earned her doctorate in physical therapy. Courses in physics, anatomy, and chemistry were the mainstay for the first 2 years, followed by 1 year of shadowing licensed physical therapists for hands-on training. One of Dogi's favorite parts of her schooling was the cadavers lab course, where she was one of 20 therapy assistants who helped guide and teach the large cadaver course. People donate their bodies to medical science, which are then used in these type of settings. Quote, "The cadavers are a great learning tool. Diseases and medical conditions described in a book are one thing. Actually seeing and touching the real thing is a completely different level of learning," Dogi said. Students can learn about muscle structure and connectivity, along with gender-specific differences, anomalies, and disease-related need for physical therapy. No two humans are built the same way. Each is a completely unique individual. Books can give the basic common structure, the old head bone is connected to the neck bone type of learning, but a physical therapist needs to learn how to grasp the normal variations among bodies. When PT students can view different pathologies, like cancers or space-occupying lesions, and see the effect on surrounding tissues, a greater impact is achieved. quote, "What is learned in a cadaver lab course can be indispensable as far as learning the extent of damage inflicted on joints and muscles due to certain diseases. The cadavers are such an important part of a PT's training that once a year we hold a memorial to honor and thank the dead who donated their bodies to science and their living relatives," Doege said. Doege's practice varies from biomechanical therapy, helping rehabilitate muscles, joints, and bone injuries, to cardiovascular therapy, to neurotherapy, helping to restore mobility, strength, balance, and coordination in people with neurological conditions. Quote, "I love to work with children, and in the neonatal intensive care unit, the NICU, Doege said. "Physical therapy in the NICU is very important to the proper development of preemie babies or those born with conditions. Neonatal physical therapy is not rehabilitative. It trains a baby's movements and developmental behaviors to prevent future problems and to offer comfort to the infant," she said. Quote, "I get to hold the babies and watch them get stronger," she said. "The human body needs to move to develop the correct muscle and skeletal structure. The physical therapist uses different tactical activities to help improve a baby's motor skills. Sucking on a pacifier helps soothe a baby. Moving its hand to its mouth and holding its head up are important functions." Doege works back and forth from the physical therapy unit to the Ward County Memorial Hospital. "As well as working in the hospital NICU, she spends time working in the swing bed unit. The swing bed unit is for patients needing short-term rehabilitation while transitioning to recovery." Doege is living with her parents, Doug and Laura Doege, for the present time. Her dad is Special Programs Director at the Monahans Wicket Pyote ISD Administration Building, and her mother is librarian at Sudirth Elementary. Quote, "Right now it's nice having mom's cooking and dad as a mechanic if needed," she laughed. Doege investigated several PT openings at other hospital facilities, but immediately knew when she found the opening here at home, this is where she was supposed to be, helping people she knows personally and who know her. Quote, "Being a physical therapist is a very rewarding profession. I love helping people learn how to ease their pain level or get completely beyond pain. Knowing I am helping a person to achieve a better quality of life is extremely satisfying," Doege said. Swanson sends three to prison. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. 143rd Judicial District Judge Mike Swanson handed down three prison sentences last week on charges of burglary, third DWI, and failure to annually register as a sex offender. George Esteban Solis Jr., age 49, of Monahans, also accepted a plea deal and pleaded guilty to failure to register as a sex offender annually, a third-degree felony. He was sentenced to 3 years confinement in the Institutional Division of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. According to the indictment, as a condition of his parole, Solis failed to report to the Ward County Sheriff's Office at least once annually during a period within 30 days before and not later than 30 days after the anniversary of the defendant's date of birth from November 18, 2020, until January 17, 2021. Solis was also ordered to pay $460 in court costs and given credit for 518 days time served. Felipe de Jesus Acosta, age 62, of Fort Worth, was sentenced to 4 years confinement in the Institutional Division of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice after he accepted a plea agreement and pleaded guilty to a charge of driving while intoxicated third or more, a third-degree felony, enhanced punishable as a second-degree felony. According to the indictment, on January 18, 2019, Acosta did knowingly operate a vehicle in a public place while intoxicated. Acosta has three other previous convictions for driving while intoxicated, all in Tarrant County, on August 1992, November 1997, and October 2012. Mendoza was also given credit for 2 days' credit to his sentence in order to pay $558 in court costs. In the third case, Nima Jeanette Lopez Mendoza, age 48, of Fort Stockton, was sentenced to 5 years' confinement in the Institutional Division of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice after waiving her right to a jury trial and accepting a plea deal on a charge of burglary, a first-degree felony. According to the indictment, on June 24, 2019, Mendoza did intentionally enter a habitation without the effective consent of the owner, Alfredo Bustillos Avila, and attempted to commit the felony offense of aggravated assault. The indictment further stated Mendoza was convicted on June 17, 2014, of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon in Ector County. She was further ordered to pay $450 in court costs and given credit for 750 days of time served. Attorneys for the state on all three cases were 143rd District Attorney Randall W. Reynolds. All three judgments were handed down on August 24th. Migrant camps grow. Biden looks to house 2,500 or more in Pecos. The story was written by Brendan Briggs. Into the year and a half the underage migrant camp has operated in Pecos, expansion is now on the horizon. The Biden administration is looking to provide up to 19,000 beds for unaccompanied migrant children processed by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the U.S. Border Patrol. Projections put the total number of underage migrants to be housed in Reeves County up to 5,000. Currently, the converted man camp owned by Target Logistics on Teague Street is rated to hold up to 2,000, but expansion plans for locations around the city look to pump those numbers up by at least 1,000 more. That 1,000-person increase does not include living space for the workers to run the camps. With the estimated population of Pecos pegged at 12,000, these migrant influx care facilities, as they have been branded by the current administration, could put a significant strain on city resources, according to Town of Pecos City Manager Charles Leno. Quote, "This is a tidal wave. I have heard numbers as high as 5,000 children being housed in town," he said. "It has been taxing on our emergency services, and often we don't feel like we are getting the full story from the federal government," end quote. Operating under the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services umbrella, the Office of Refugee Resettlement contracted with San Antonio-based care service provider Endeavors and with Target Logistics to handle the influx of migrants encountered over the past 2 years. The federal contract means the city is losing out on hotel occupancy taxes that would normally be paid if the facility was a normal oil-filled man camp, resulting in an estimated loss of $300,000 over the past year. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has been busing willing immigrants to Washington, D.C. and New York City over the past 2 months, and just this week, the city of El Paso sent 35 Venezuelan immigrants to New York City. The number of Venezuelans encountered by the U.S. Border Patrol at the southwest border has skyrocketed to nearly 128,000 as of July this fiscal year. That's 2.5 times more than in all of the 2021 fiscal year that ended in September, according to the latest agency statistics.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.